is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Well, it finally happened. For the first time since the 2020 campaign season began, an official televised debate of Democratic presidential candidates managed to fit all on one stage and hash it all out on a single night. Now, not that the pool was totally full. There were a couple of hopefuls who didn't qualify for the event from Houston, but the field of Dems is starting, slowly, to get smaller. Well, just the opposite of what's happening in the GOP. Donald Trump's bid for re-election is now facing challenges from three fellow Republicans, including former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who announced his candidacy this week. Policy ideas and campaign messaging are starting to come together and gain more visibility, but it's easy for frontrunners to lose their footing in this phase of the political season. What did we hear and learn about the candidates this week? We'll discuss that and much more of the week's top news on the roundup today. I'm joined by Shauna Thomas. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. She's in New York on this Friday. Shauna, good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Todd.
Shane Harris is here from the Washington Post. He covers intelligence and national security. He's also author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Welcome back, Shane.
Good to see you, Todd.
And Eliana Johnson is here, White House reporter for Politico. Eliana's also the incoming brand new editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon, some news that Washington got this week. Congratulations, Eliana.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And good to have you here as well. Well, let's start with politics, because if you crave brutal, bone-crunching battles on live television, you could have watched the NFL on Thursday night. But the real bloodlusters opted for Dem-on-Dem violence. They watched the third Democratic presidential debate, the top 10 candidates clashing in Houston. It's the first time frontrunner Joe Biden shared the stage with Elizabeth Warren, one of the leading progressive candidates in the race. But most of the standout moments came from Tier 2 candidates last night, such as this big one from former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
And in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15. In Odessa and Midland, there weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against
Beto O'Rourke with some Texas real talk when it comes to guns. Shauna Thomas, you're from Houston. Here's some Houston privilege. What did we learn last night?
You know, I think talking specifically about Beto O'Rourke, after the El Paso shooting, it's very clear that he decided to make his campaign sort of about guns and assault weapons. And he has been traveling to some places that you wouldn't normally travel to if you're running in a Democratic primary to push that message. And so he continued to push it. It seems like some of that was definitely planned. They immediately had merchandise out on their website. But that sort of him going so far in the assault weapons ban, I thought was really interesting because it's such an easy thing for Republicans to kind of turn around and say, hey, look, the Democrats, if you're going to paint them with a broad brush, want to actually take all your guns away. It's not about magazines. It's not about, background checks. It's about actually taking your guns.
Is that true even if Beto at this point is pretty unlikely to be president? I mean, he's in the sort of mid to the bottom of the second tier. I guess he could surge back. But if none of the top tier, if Joe Biden's never saying that and Elizabeth Warren is never saying that, are the rest of the Democrats vulnerable then on this charge?
I'm not saying it's totally true for everybody, but I am saying that in terms of a 2020 campaign and the kind of spin that we expect to see in this kind of campaign, Republicans will say, you know, over in this corner, they don't want to build a wall. They want to decriminalize crossing the border. Over in this corner, they want to take your guns away. This is about creating a narrative, and President Trump is pretty good at creating that narrative, and Beto sort of helped him. Now, if you want to get out of that second tier you were talking about, you got to have a stronger message, and that's what he's going for.
Making a moment on national TV because you don't get a lot of chances. Eliana, where is the race now? It's pretty clear we've got some well-established tiers. This is sort of a convention of primary campaign politics. Biden, Warren, and Sanders at the top. I will tell you this. I did not hear the word impeachment last night at all. It's big news inside the Beltway and in the halls of Congress, but nobody on that national stage last night talked about it.
That's right. It's something that an issue these candidates clearly want to shy away from, but also something that the moderators didn't bring up. which is interesting given what a dominant subject it is among congressional Democrats. Also didn't hear all that much about the economy, given what an important issue it is for this president in his reelection campaign. One thing I think is surprising is how relatively little tumult there's been in this Democratic field. It's really been, I think, relatively stable. When you look at the Republican race 4 years ago, Scott Walker was a front runner, Ben Carson was a front runner, Ted Cruz was a front runner. We had several different front runners in that race before ultimately Donald Trump overtook them. And it really was thrilling and exciting, I think, for political junkies. This race really has been pretty stable. Nobody has been able to displace Joe Biden as the front runner. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have always been in that top tier of candidates. And it doesn't look really like any of these debates have changed the fundamental dynamics of the race, or they may not change until we have an nominee.
Shane, I realize I'm mixing rank politics with constitutional imperatives in the House, but on this impeachment question, there was a lot of confusion in the House early this week about what exactly the House Democrats are doing and not doing. And I saw some Democrats endeavoring to clarify by the end of the week that they are pursuing an impeachment procedure, even if they haven't impeached yet. Where are we at?
Well, I'm not sure how much they clarified, actually. So you had Jerry Nadler chairing a hearing where essentially they were setting up rules for what the investigation process might look like. And essentially he said, call it whatever you want. I'm sick of this debate about what he said is nomenclature. Do we have an investigation or an inquiry, or are we approaching impeachment, or kind of coming at it from the side? Speaker Pelosi asked about this, essentially saying she doesn't want to talk about it either, and she will not concede that they're in the midst of an investigation. Look, for all practical intents and purposes, they are in one, right? And they've said as much in court, Democrats have, when they've tried to go to pry records from the administration and saying, we are having an impeachment inquiry here. The words do matter, though, because, of course, the moment that Democrats, particularly leadership, signal we're in a formal impeachment inquiry, then the next question is, okay, so when are the articles of impeachment coming? So it's a little silly kind of to see them dancing around it, but it's very important that they don't quite go over that line. And the nomenclature, contrary to what Congressman Nadler said, it actually does matter quite a bit.
Democrats are wondering where they're going to land on this, and where things land was another story in this orbit this week. What started out as a story about one American Air Force crew landing in Scotland and staying at a Donald Trump golf resort, Dunberg, by the week's end, Shane, turned into a story of busloads of American taxpayer-funded Air Force air crews arriving at a Trump resort to stay overnight when there are cheaper hotels much closer to the airport where they landed. Now, I know I shoved this into the context of an impeachment inquiry. Democrats have been focused on the Mueller report, but is this the kind of thing that could land in an article of impeachment eventually?
It could, absolutely. I mean, we talk about this thing called the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution. It's actually clauses. You can't take money essentially from a foreign source or potentate, and the U.S. government can't pay the president in excess of what his salary is. So the question becomes, is effectively this is what's going on here, is that the military is putting money in the president's pocket. Now, this is not a new issue. This question of the president making money off people staying at his properties, it hasn't
but
been
not just
of
people.
Military service.
Right. Taxpayer funded.
And he
people.
Is the commander in chief. I mean, he could presumably tell them where to stay. There's no indication he's actually directed them to do it yet. There are a number of things that are not Mueller and not Russia related that absolutely could become potential. I think it's a question of what the appetite is for impeachment among Democrats. It seems quite low. And whether or not these things resonate with the American people as scandalous to the point of being intolerable, because a lot of about what the president has done, a lot of Democrats think is scandalous, but I think they'd rather address that at the ballot box.
I want to ask you, if I can, though, about the president and his reelection prospects. Pretty strong. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to win the nomination, but he did draw another primary challenger this week. We mentioned Mark Sanford, the former congressman, the former governor of South Carolina. What else do we need to know about Mark Sanford?
Well, Mark Sanford lost his reelection to be congressman, and he is very much so a fiscal conservative, kind of old school Republican in that Tea Party vein that we've seen, and has spoken out somewhat against President Trump. He doesn't think Trump represents the fiscal conservatism that he represents, and he's coming out and saying, I want to challenge him. Now, as you alluded to sort of in your intro into this, trying to challenge the sitting president of the United States for a primary is really hard, because every time the president goes out and speaks and does an event, except for maybe last night when he was counter-programmed by a debate on a major network, it's news. And so this is sort of a shot in the dark for people like Mark Sanford or former Congressman Joe Walsh. Part of why Mark Sanford, people say he lost, is he didn't really have the endorsement of the president of the United States in his reelection bid. And Mark Sanford has some issues in his past when it comes to an affair that he had. Mm-hmm. So is he the best, you know, person to carry on the Republican mantle when they actually own the presidency right now? Probably not. But it is interesting more people are coming out. But unless we see members of Congress, sitting members of Congress, other than, I believe, Justin Amash, come out and say, you know what, we don't want this guy to lead us anymore. They're fun interviews to do. Mark Sanford is a great interview. There are interesting people to talk about. It's interesting to talk about this sort of fight within the Republican Party for its identity. But I just don't see this as a credible challenge to the sitting president.
All right. Well, we have a lot more politics to get to. We're going to take a quick break. But before we do, there was some big news via tweet from rap and country star Lil Nas X. That's right. We do a lot of Lil Nas X news on this show. Here's some more. His second single, Panini, is getting the remix treatment. You know Old Town Road. It got a lot of remixes, including K-pop all over the map. Panini is coming out on the remix. Lil Nas X says, how many are you going to get? He says, up to 25. It's the Friday News Roundup. More with Politico's Ileana Johnson, Shauna Thomas of Vice News, Shane Harris of the Washington Post, and a little more Lil Nas X. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. Stay close. Hey, Panini, don't you be a meanie. Thought you wanted me to go. Why you trying to keep me teeny now? Now they need me. Number one, I'm screaming. Oh, yeah, you used to love me. So what happened? What's the meaning?
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. The Grow with Google initiative supports small businesses by providing free digital skills workshops and one-on-one coaching in all 50 states, helping businesses get online, connect with new customers, and work more productively. Learn more at google.com/grow.
Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so that other people can find the show too. We appreciate it.
I can't believe that summer is basically over.
I know. And you know what that means. The 2020 presidential race is only going to heat up.
It's a good thing we spent all summer sitting down with the Democratic candidates for president.
Hello.
It is great to be with you.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Check out the NPR Politics podcast feed for exclusive interviews with all the candidates on the debate stage.
Subscribe.
Okay.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Speaking of Beto's big moment when it comes to guns on the national debate stage last night, we got this tweet from Phil. Beto never said he would take all the guns. He specifically said he would buy back assault rifles and mentioned AK-47s and AR-15s. Shauna Thomas, is that a distinction with a difference that will land on Donald Trump and conservatives when you predict they'll attack this as a gun takeaway?
I don't think so. I don't think that's I do understand the idea of wanting to be specific about what former Congressman O'Rourke said. But to certain parts of the Republican Party, if you start talking about buybacks and lessening their access to weapons, that is something that they are fearful of and they don't think the government should do it. I think with Democrats having that issue-based sort of conversation and trying to figure out whose side do you want to be on when it comes to guns is a real thing. But with Republicans, it's just too easy to spin this.
Now, an assault weapons ban is relatively popular with the American public. Some people think this election, we don't know yet, may be won or lost in the suburbs. I want to talk about a race that happened this week, Ileana, that had a big play when it comes to the suburbs, both suburban and rural voters. Let's go to North Carolina, the 9th district in North Carolina. There was a special election. This is still part of the 2018 midterms, believe it or not.
Yep.
Yeah, we're still closing the book on the 2018 midterms, but there was a close race in a district, the North Carolina 9th, that Donald Trump won by 12 points. Now, I'm willing to give you the spoiler here. The Republican won this race, but won it by 2 points. What does that tell us?
look, I think you can read it both ways, and it's tough to know with these special elections. In 2018, the candidate tampered with ballot boxes. The Republican candidate tampered with ballots, and he only won that race by, I think it was 0.8 points, by an even smaller margin. So this new Republican candidate won by a greater margin than in 2018, but still far less than the margin that Donald Trump won by in 2016. And he got a lot of help from Trump and the vice president, who went down and campaigned for him.
But I want to talk about where that help lands, right? Because the interesting thing about the North Carolina 9th is that it is a mixture of rural voters, Donald Trump and Mike Pence's base. I get it. They're going to really respond to a Trump visit. Suburban voters, where the Republican candidate, now the congressperson-elect, did very, very poorly. I came into this talking about an assault weapons ban. It's true what Shauna says. The Republican base might hate that idea. People in the suburbs, they might be for it.
Right. I mean, I think the takeaway really is that the Republican Party is transforming, and it is becoming a more and more rural party. And the Democratic Party, conversely, is becoming an urban party. And I think you can look to those trends to continue as we head into the 2020 election.
Is it true that there's a conventional wisdom developing here? Do you see it that Donald Trump is getting a bigger share of a smaller party? The Republican Party is shrinking. The base is shrinking, even if Donald Trump is getting a stronger hold on it.
I think that's probably right. Trump is a unique candidate. So I think what I would add to that is simply that because Trump is a unique candidate, it's difficult to know what that says broadly about the GOP. What would a GOP under Nikki Haley be the same sort of party as it would be under Trump? Probably not. But under Trump, certainly the party is becoming a much more rural party with a smaller base. I think that's right.
Shauna, we had a lot of news of the hurricane that hit the Bahamas hard last week. And this week, some of the aftermath, some of the political aftermath here in Washington. There are two congressional committees that are now investigating whether anyone in the White House acted inappropriately to retaliate against weather forecasters at the National Weather Service or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration when they contradicted the president. All of this after Hurricane Dorian. President Trump has denied, he denied it on Wednesday, that he instructed anyone on his staff to rebuke weather forecasters for contradicting his claims about the threats to Alabama. The New York Times, though, reported that the president did, in fact, set in motion a chain of events that led to the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross threatening to fire top officials at NOAA and tell them that they're going to be out if they don't toe the line. Shauna, this story seems like it might be petty, like it shouldn't matter, like people might roll their eyes, but I wonder if you see it that way.
Well, I have to admit, with the whole Sharpie gate, which went on for a pretty long time about whether Alabama was in the path of that hurricane that killed many people, basically destroyed part of the Bahamas, I was like, this is not the point, guys. And then this came out about threats against officials within NOAA for doing their jobs. And at that point, it does start to become an important story about how we run our government and what do we allow people to do. And are there any parts of our government where politics doesn't necessarily have to get involved? And I think everyone on this radio show would think that at least something like, okay, this is a science-based organization within the Department of Commerce. We rely on them for information about weather. How could politics ever get involved in this? And somehow this administration managed to do it. And at least according to the New York Times, seemed to think it was okay to threaten people over it. That really, I mean, I think this is one of those things that should play into 2020. And people should think about how do they want their overall government run, especially the parts that shouldn't really involve politics.
And the political operation, whether it's the president or not, threatening scientists at a scientific organization within the government has been branded by some people as a form of corruption, a form of intellectual corruption, if you like. It is an important story.
Which also plays into the impeachment conversation as well. And also brain drain within our government. Why, if you are a scientist, do you want to work for some place that says don't do your job?
Shane, I'm glad you're here, as always, because whenever national security stories come up and we really have to dig in, I'm always glad that you're sitting at the table, because there's a fascinating real-world spy thriller. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says It's nonsense. But CNN reported this week that the U.S. had recruited a mid-level Russian official decades ago. He slowly worked his way up the government ranks and landed a top spot in the Kremlin, sending valuable information to the United States over the years. Now, after the 2016 election and concerns that the Trump administration was mishandling covert information, that the president himself was revealing classified information, the U.S. decided to extract this spy. Now, the Kremlin responded to the story with a big yawn, saying that he was kind of a boozy nobody, downplaying that this person was important. Media outlets have identified this spy as Oleg B. Smolenkov. What do we know about Oleg? Is he real, and how important was he?
Well, we know he's a real person. he owns a house out in Stafford, Virginia, which I went out and visited, did not find him at home this week. We don't know 100% that he is this individual that's been reported by CNN and confirmed by us and the New York Times and others that was providing information about the election interference, but his profile very closely matches that person, and the Kremlin has strongly suggested that he might be. If this is true, I mean, there's a way in which this is actually something of a good news story in that the CIA was able to recruit an asset very well placed within the inner circle of the Russian leadership. That's kind of a golden source in espionage. We don't have many of those, and we really haven't had many of those in Russia, even going back to the Cold War. So if this individual was the one who was providing information about Russian election interference, and particularly Vladimir Putin's direction of it, that becomes a very critical piece of understanding how it is that the intelligence community was so certain back in 2016 that Putin was weighing in, trying to influence the election, and that he had a preference for which candidate.
Because they may have had eyes on him for real.
Exactly. And certainly had other technical intelligence trying back to them. But when you've also got somebody who's kind of vouching for this thing that you're seeing from what you're tracking on the computer and what you're seeing in the other intelligence, that's huge.
Now, what about the cause here? The initial reporting on this story said that Oleg, if he's the guy, was pulled in part because of fear and distrust about the president's ability to keep the lid on classified information. They were afraid that the president might burn him. That not only burns a source, but could cost him his life. Later reporting, I think including your reporting, downplayed that part of the story, said no, it was because it was clear the United States knew about election interference and that Oleg was the guy who had eyes on that, and they extracted him as a matter of good spycraft. How do we understand the discrepancy, or is there one here?
Well, I think there is something of a discrepancy. I mean, we should be clear, too, that it's rare. It's usually not the case, and I don't think it's the case here, that it's simply one event that might be tangential to the matter, like the president revealing some information, by the way, about counterterrorism and ISIS to Russian officials that had nothing to do with election interference. That would not necessarily prompt the CIA to say, quick, get the guy out of there. But I think it is totally the case that in the context of this decision to bring this person out, I think because of the building scrutiny around this question of, well, how did we know that Vladimir Putin ordered this election interference? I mean, we knew covering this that the signs were pointing to a spy in the Kremlin pretty early on, and certainly the Russians understood that. But in the context of that, you do have an intelligence community that is very on edge because the president is so undisciplined when it comes to information security and kind of keeping close to the vest how it is that we know what we know about counterterrorism and ISIS and the like. And not the proximate cause of what happened, but certainly I think that was in the minds of officials when they were contemplating bringing this guy out of Russia.
Now, hold that thought, because I want to stick with national security, and this one's for you too, Shane. The national security advisor, John Bolton, gone. He's the fourth national security advisor for this White House. He says he resigned. The president says he was fired, and the president spoke about it as the week progressed.
John wasn't in line with what we were doing, and actually, in some cases, he thought it was too tough what we were doing. Mr. Tough Guy, you know, you have to go into Iraq. Going into Iraq was something that he felt very strongly about. So we're right now in for over $7 trillion into the Middle East. And I don't say it was his decision. You had a president and you had other people also, but he was very out there, I can tell you, and wanting to have them do it.
Shane Harris, where does this leave American foreign policy?
Well, not any more or less chaotic than it already was. You know, Donald Trump knew all those things about John Bolton, by the way, and he hired him anyway. And never made any pretense about having some concerns about what he called his hawkishness, which I think is true. But Donald Trump is his own national security advisor. I mean, John Bolton was probably the most vivid illustration of how there's no internal process for making policy and foreign policy in this administration. He very much tried to close the door on that. But there really wasn't a process even with the previous national security advisors. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, is the one who has figured out how to really have influence with this president and be an advisor to him. And it largely revolves around not contradicting him, either publicly or privately, which is something that John Bolton did all the time, and you see what happened.
And now, as the White House looks for a replacement, there's even trial balloons going up that Mike Pompeo might take over both jobs, Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. That's the Henry Kissinger model. A lot of people have remembered and noticed that it's the Henry Kissinger model, wondering if they want to return to those days. Let's talk immigration, Eliana, because the Supreme Court signed off on the Trump administration's move this week to limit asylum claims for people coming from Central America. This rule, quote, prohibits migrants who have resided in or traveled through third countries from seeking asylum in the United States, therefore barring people traveling through Mexico from being able to claim asylum at all, according to CNN. Remind us again what applying for asylum means and what the Supreme Court ruling means now.
Right. I think that's not quite an accurate description. It bans people coming from Central America for applying for asylum if they haven't already applied for asylum in the first country they traveled through. So Hondurans and Salvadorans have to seek and be denied asylum in either Guatemala or Mexico before they can apply for asylum in the United States. Guatemalans have to do that in Mexico. So really, it's like the U.S. has to be a last resort for these people. And asylum seekers, the definition really is that they have to be fleeing persecution and fear for their lives in their home country. And the definition even, the Trump administration has sought to tighten. But really, the Supreme Court issued a very short ruling with only two dissents in it, saying that this should be allowed to go through a fuller court process. Immigrants' rights group were seeking a more expeditious decision from the court, but this will now go all the way through the court system, which could take many months. Came as a disappointment to these immigrant rights groups, but the policy could still ultimately be overturned.
Shauna, put this ruling from the Supreme Court in the broader context of the immigration debate and how the White House is driving the bus here.
I mean, I think we have to go back to this idea that 2020 is looming. The president of the United States is running for re-election. And the main thing one of the biggest things he ran on in 2016 was building a wall and changing how we do immigration in this country and limiting immigration, whether that be legal or illegal with this administration. And so what this does is this is something very concrete that he can now point to and say, you know what? I want to limit the people who are coming through Mexico, who are coming from those Central American countries. I have put this in place. The Supreme Court has at least upheld it temporarily as it works through that process that Eliana talked about. And I am trying to protect you. I am trying to make sure people don't take your jobs away. That is the message the president has very consistently been using since 2016. And here's something concrete he can now point to, since he cannot point to an actual wall or any new wall that has been built since he ran in 2016. So that's sort of the larger 2020 context. And I think in another way, it does show sort of where the presidency has power versus where it doesn't. And in this case, when it comes to especially foreign policy, sort of talking about John Bolton before, and immigration, those are things that the executive branch can manipulate. And we now have a Supreme Court that's saying, okay, you can do what you want, President Trump, on this as we play the whole process out, instead of a lot of the other things that have had injunctions put on them.
Shane?
Yeah, I think that's right. The president has, I mean, we remember one of the first acts he ever took in office was this ban on people coming from predominantly Muslim countries. And the way it was written immediately kind of ran into the buzzsaw of the courts. Then they figured out how to write it. And I think if the broad sort of arc, the long arc of this immigration narrative with the administration is they are figuring out, as Shauna said, the places where the president has authority. And he has tremendous authority as any president when it comes to these kinds of security issues. And they're playing it where they can. And this will allow him, if it plan works out for him, to be able to go to the voters and say, look, I told told you I was going to crack down on crossings at the border. I did that. How he did it is not necessarily, I think, going to be so important for Republican voters. It will be a huge issue, of course, for Democratic voters.
We talked about the base at the top of this discussion and the ways the president can bring out his base. This is surely one. But does he risk also, the left is very exercised about these immigration announcements and rulings. You risk energizing the other base as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he has. And I think it then becomes incumbent, obviously, on the Democratic nominee to make sure that they stay energized.
We're going to catch up on some health headlines next when the Friday News Roundup continues with Eliana Johnson of Politico, Shane Harris of The Washington Post, and Shauna Thomas of Vice News. You're listening to the Friday News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make for safer journeys for everyone. All driver partners go through a multi-step safety screen before their first trip, including driving and criminal history checks. And Uber is introducing a brand new safety technology called RideCheck, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
When you think of country music, you probably have a particular image in mind. But as you can imagine, the history is way more complicated.
This week on Throughline, we sit down with filmmaker Ken Burns to talk about his new documentary about the origins of country music.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.
As we return to the news of the week, the country continues to contend with the opioid crisis. And this week, we saw new developments in the case against Purdue Pharma. That's the company that created OxyContin, a highly addictive painkiller that the multi-state lawsuit that's been in play for well over a year in this country, a couple of years, says fueled the opioid crisis. According to a survey by NBC, officials from 27 states have agreed to the terms of a settlement with Purdue, but at least 21 others rejected those terms. Maggie Fox is here with us in the studio. Maggie is a longtime health and science and medical reporter here in Washington, D.C. She's freelance. She's an esteemed colleague of mine. Maggie, I'm glad you're here to help us understand some of the complex health news of the week. What are the terms of this offer between the Sackler family, their company, Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, oxycodone, and state attorneys general and victims?
Well, the Sackler family has made an offer to basically liquidate their company. They're going to offer $3 billion from the company itself. They're offering another $1.5 billion, a possible total of $12 billion over time. In return, they want to go into Chapter 11. And that's why some of the other states are objecting to this agreement. They say, actually, Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family are wiggling out of a lot of their commitments. They say the family's been pulling money out of the company over time. Their accusation is that it's in anticipation of an agreement like this. And they say the money being offered is not going to be anywhere near enough to take care of all the problems that have been caused by the opioid crisis.
Well, the Attorney General in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, tweeted this. I'm quoting, Purdue Pharma has provided an insultingly weak offer to the American people for the opioid epidemic that they fueled for decades. It allows them to walk away billionaires and admit no wrongdoing. I don't accept that. If Attorney General Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania does not accept that, and it's pretty clear he doesn't, where does it leave the settlement? Where does it leave victims? Where does it leave the Sackler family?
Well, it leaves a lot of it up in the air because, of course, in at least 21 states, there are still going to be lawsuits going on. It doesn't take the Sackler family off the hook. These kinds of settlements are complicated. This is what the U.S. went through back in the 90s with the comprehensive tobacco settlement with the tobacco companies. And they ended up with hundreds of billions of dollars that went to the states, but it took a long time to negotiate. It ended up with many compromises that a lot of tobacco advocates were unhappy with. And, of course, this is one company and one family. There's lots of companies that have made opioids that are the subject of lawsuits by states and by localities who say, you know what, you really push these drugs on doctors, you push these drugs on patients, you told people they weren't safe, you marketed them in unethical ways, and we want all of you to pay. The Sacklers and the Purdue company have been the focus of this particular settlement, but it leaves a lot of stuff out in the open yet.
And there are other settlements that have already been executed in places like Oklahoma. Well, last question on this, Maggie. If Pennsylvania, one big state, says not good enough, there are other states out there that say not good enough, what is the point when a settlement deal can be made? Does any one state have veto power? Can they leave the deal and sue separately? How does it work?
Well, yes. I mean, states, of course, can sue separately. It'll be up to the federal courts to try to negotiate, try to coordinate something bigger and better. In the meantime, it's going to be a bit of a free-for-all.
All right. I want to get to another huge health story while you're here, Maggie. And we've already teased it a little bit this hour. It's on vaping. Smoking cigarettes is way down in this country. That's good news. But millions and millions of Americans are still addicted to nicotine. We learned this week, in a surprise, that the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is going to step in on a crisis. Here's President Trump once again talking to the press this week.
Vaping has become a very big business, as I understand it, like a giant business in a very short period of time. But we can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected. And I'm hearing it, and that's how the First Lady got involved. And she's got a son together that is a beautiful young man, and she feels very, very strongly about it.
President of the United States giving his justification for a limited vaping ban. Now, the Secretary of Health and Human Services announced that in the coming weeks, the Food and Drug Administration, under his purview, would release a plan to remove flavored e-cigarette and nicotine pods from the market. Maggie, what is this, a ban? And the real question is, why now?
Well, ban's not a great word for this. In 2016, the FDA said that anyone who wanted to sell e-cigarettes had to go through the FDA approval process. They then put that on hold. The former FDA commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, said, you know what, they need until 2022 to do this because we've only just started the framework for the rules. The companies don't even know what they're going to have to do to get through our process. Now, the Trump administration says they're going to roll that back and have directed the FDA to come up with a new set of rules through which the e-cigarette manufacturers are going to have to seek FDA approval for their products. The FDA can, in the meantime, say you may not market your products until you get approval. It's not exactly a ban.
What's the distinction between flavored vaping, flavored e-cigarettes, flavors like, you know, Jolly Rancher, birthday cake, clearly marketed to get kids hooked, and vaping products that tastes like a cigarette and nobody would probably like it except an adult or at least a teenager or later?
Well, of course, the e-cigarette manufacturers say that adults do like these products. Almost everybody else says, yeah, these are aimed at kids. Nicotine has a nasty flavor, and that's one of the problems with e-cigarettes in general is that the makers use a product called nicotine salts to make it taste a little less nasty. Apparently, that also gets it into your blood faster, gets it into your system faster. That's one objection that advocates have. And, of course, these flavors. When you survey teenagers and young kids, they name the flavors overall as the main reason they're attracted to the e-cigarettes, especially the fruity flavors and the candy flavors.
Well, listeners are chiming in on this point. Nicholas says hundreds of thousands die every year from cigarettes, yet there's no call for a ban there. And Bill asks this on Twitter, why are people more concerned with vaping than they are with regular cigarettes? And this gets to a couple of disturbing points in the data, Maggie. Teen smoking is way, way down over the last two decades. But I saw a disturbing chart that came out yesterday or the day before that shows that decline curve spiking back up when it comes to vaping. All of those kids, I say all of the percentage of kids who've given up cigarettes have grabbed a hold of vapes and they're using nicotine again.
Even more disturbing, Todd, it's kids who never smoked, never even thought of smoking. Teen smoking is, as you say, way down, and the latest preliminary figures from the CDC show that 27.5% of kids say that they are, recent e-cigarette users. The definition is if you've tried one in the past 30 days, you're considered a current user. That is way more than kids ever smoked. There's many, many more kids vaping than ever used traditional cigarettes, and that's what's so troubling. Also troubling is that, of course, these are great nicotine delivery vehicles, and there's a lot of evidence to show that kids are way more easily addicted than adults are, and also that nicotine has effects on their brains. Further troubling, the kids have no idea what's in these e-cigarettes. Many don't realize nicotine is in them. Many don't realize it's addictive. And a lot of people, hardly anybody, knows what's actually in the flavoring products. And that brings up another troubling event. Recent event is these six people who have died apparently because of vaping. Another more than 200, close to 300 people who have been made ill, according to the CDC.
Which is a separate, that's contamination, a whole separate issue from the long-term chronic effects of vaping. This is an acute illness.
This is an acute illness. It's not clear if it's contamination or if it's a deliberate part of the e-cigarette formula. Nobody's quite clear yet whether these are homemade vapes, whether it's people who have been vaping cannabis or THC or CBD oil. It's very unclear. What is clear is that it causes a really severe form of pneumonia that puts almost every patient into the hospital. About a third of them have to go on ventilators. It's not clear what their long-term outcomes are. And if six people have died, that's serious.
Well, Maggie, here's a complicated question. Easier to answer when it comes to kids. We don't want them vaping. We'll see if the White House and the FDA follow through on anything that could look like a ban for candy-flavored vaping to maybe discourage kids to stay off it. But a lot of experts have warned that while we don't want kids vaping, vaping could be less dangerous than cigarettes. And if adults are vaping instead of smoking, that could be for the overall good. They call it harm reduction, and they say it's a little counterintuitive, but if grown adults are vaping, maybe they're not smoking Marlboros, which we know are dangerous, and maybe it actually helps.
Well, there is some evidence that it can help people transition away from cigarettes, but it's not entirely clear. What is clear is that kids who have never smoked before are vaping. It's also clear that kids who vape are more likely to go on and try and use tobacco. It gets very, very messy because, you know, some people are arguing if you ban vapes, you're going to just send kids back to cigarettes. You're going to send adults back to cigarettes. So what do you do? But it's also clear that the companies who make these products have not proven that they help people quit smoking. They have not proven that their products are safer than cigarettes. And what the FDA is saying now is, well, if you're going to say these things, and these companies are saying those things, you need to prove it.
Well, gang, before we round out the hour, I want to return us to California. We had some news on immigration from California. We mentioned an upcoming show on Monday here on WENA about labor and labor markets and Uber and other companies and labor rules in California. Now, the Trump administration is planning a major crackdown on California's homelessness issue, one which might include destroying encampments in some major cities. Shauna, what's the background here? How bad is the homelessness problem in California, and why is President Trump suddenly interested?
Well, the homelessness problem in California is pretty bad, especially in the Los Angeles area, and it's something that has been in the news there for a long time. And how do you make sure these people have some place to live? It's a little unclear why President Trump latched on to this particular issue. Now, it has been reported that Rudy Giuliani said that President Trump internally at the White House has been talking about the homeless issue, and that there are spaces the administration had gone out and had started sort of looking for places to put more homeless people in Los Angeles. But the weird thing about this issue is it didn't seem like we were going into a lot of details about why these people were homeless, just where can you put them? And that's a very strange conversation to have.
Yeah. Eliana, what are they talking about in terms of solutions? Shauna's right. They're not talking about root causes. They're talking about getting people rounded up off the street and where to house them.
That's right. Yeah. No talk about what's caused these people to be on the streets, but the president is contemplating a trip out to California next week, potentially to look at some sites. There was talk of an airplane hangar of some sorts or an FAA facility where the homeless in Los Angeles could there would be an effort to move them from essentially from outside to inside. So it does seem in some sense like a cosmetic solution to really a festering problem, both in Los Angeles and in San Francisco unless there's more detail that we haven't gotten.
What is the president trying to do here? Is he trying to show that he's the one who's tackling this problem when the big city mayors aren't?
I think there's part of that, and I think it's also part of a kind of tough on crime, tough on tough on immigration approach, where he says he's going to clean up problems in these urban areas where state and city officials haven't been able to.
Well, Shane, what's the authority here? There have been a lot of questions about this. Does the federal government have the legal right to parachute into an American city, Los Angeles in this case, and commandeer an issue like this?
I don't think so. I mean, the federal government doesn't have the right to round you up and necessarily put you in an abandoned FAA facility. I'm not sure this has been thought through, which, I mean, this often happens with, you know, policies in the White House. Would the state have jurisdiction here that they would say the federal government's preempting? I mean, there's so much of it that's not really clear. Putting aside, you know, the optics of it, does the president really want to be, what, rounding people up in buses and moving them out to a camp? I mean, this is particularly a time when the immigration debate is so heated. It doesn't seem to me that the White House has fully baked this thing and really thought through what the legal implications are and what the jurisdictional ones are. The president, I think, just wants to maybe, this is kind of an out of sight, out of mind solution, perhaps.
Have there been any negotiations with local officials on the city council or the mayor's office or even officials in California about this that we know about?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I think that some of these officials are finding out about this in news reports and are saying that they have not been having detailed conversations with the White House about this.
Well, we will see if this trial balloon from the White House winds up in court, winds up sort of dying under its own weight, or becomes an actual policy from the Trump administration. Well, I want to thank all of my guests for being here. Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Thanks for joining us, Shauna.
Thank you. And I just want to say thank you to Denise Couture, your supervising senior producer, who has been incredibly great every time I've been on 1A.
Today is Denise's last Friday News Roundup after many, many years of producing, and we congratulate her. Shauna, thank you. Shane Harris is an intelligence national security reporter for The Washington Post. Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico, and Maggie Fox, who writes on health and science. Maggie, great to see you. Our lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Chris Castano. We'll dive into the international section of the Roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
It has been a week. President Trump is looking for yet another national security advisor, his fourth one. He ousted John Bolton from the post earlier this week. John Bolton, for the record, says he resigned. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in a tight race to retain power in Israel. He promised to annex a large swath of the West Bank if he's reelected next week. In the UK, Boris Johnson's bid to push through Brexit has taken many twists and turns. And another storm is brewing in the waters off of the Bahamas. We'll continue to monitor that situation in the Bahamas, where Hurricane Dorian left at least 50 people dead and more than 1,000 missing. It's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. Joining me in the studio, Edward Luce. He's chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. His latest book, The Retreat of Western Liberalism. As always, Ed, great to have you.
Great to be here, Tom.
Indira Lakshmanan is executive editor at the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Indira, great to have you.
Thank you, Todd.
And Daniel Kurtz-Phelan is executive editor of Foreign Affairs, the magazine. He's also author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945 to 1947. Daniel, great to have you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start where we began. I want to start with the National Security Advisor in the White House. Another one has cycled through the Trump White House, John Bolton, the third person to be in that role. He was ousted earlier this week. Indira, what happened? What was the last straw? Do we know? We know that there's lots of tension between John Bolton and the president when it comes to the actual details of foreign policy. Do we know what snapped the thread here?
Well, first of all, there were so many straws. So, you know, we can begin by counting them off. But I think the most recent one was that John Bolton, who many listeners know, is a real hawk, a neocon who served in the George W. Bush administration, was very pro-Iraq war, also has supported bombing Iran and, you know, ramping up conflicts in general. He was very opposed to the idea of having the Taliban meeting in the presidential retreat in Maryland in Camp David, which nobody really knew was happening until Trump broke the news himself on Saturday saying, I'm no longer going to have that secret meeting with the Taliban where we were going to sign the peace deal because I'm so mad at them for killing one U.S. serviceman among the many, you know, hundreds and thousands of Afghans who they've been killing all along.
It was a pretext that did not ring true for a lot of people.
It did not. And I think the issue was that while President Trump has gone along with a lot of pressure and policy moves by John Bolton, including getting out of the Iran deal, you know, there are a lot of other things that he hasn't gone along with. He has been open to talks with North Korea. He's been open to talks now with Iran. We've even heard reports about him considering a possible financial bailout for Iran, despite Bolton having pushed him to put more sanctions on Iran. So there were a lot of ways in which they were not really copacetic with each other. One is a hawk and the other one really, that is President Trump, doesn't want to get into any new wars.
Well, on Thursday, my guest was former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, from the Obama administration. She was here discussing her memoir, but we also talked about John Bolton and his exit from the White House. Here's what she had to say.
It's more of a sign that Trump doesn't want dissent around him. But it's no secret, of course, that John Bolton facilitated or shepherded the withdrawal from the Iran deal, from the INF, that he invoked the specter of military intervention in Venezuela. And so from the standpoint of actually sensible policymaking, I'm not sure that it's a huge loss.
Certainly the case from the perspective of Samantha Power of the Obama administration, Ed. But what were John Bolton's main contributions to foreign policy while he lasted as National Security Advisor?
Well, he brought with him knowledge of the system and how it works that others in the administration, including even Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, lacked. But I would say he played the hawk in the room, and Trump likes to have tough talk. He likes to appear tough. It's funny, this week after Bolton resigned / was fired, Trump claimed, no, that he was the tough one on Venezuela. It wasn't Bolton. Trump doesn't like to appear weak, so he likes people who are hawkish around him. But I think the contribution ultimately of John Bolton to the Trump administration is to unite it around Donald Trump, because there are now no contrarian voices left. Pompeo is really a past master. He's the best yet at filtering and even anticipating what Trump wants and executing it. Some would call it an obsequious role as Secretary of State, but there is no contrarian voice left now. And I guess that was John Bolton's contribution, if that's the right word.
Well, Daniel Kurtzfalen, if that's true, what Ed says, that the national security opinion and apparatus is coalescing around the whims of the president now, can we divine what that means for U.S. policy toward North Korea or Iran or Afghanistan going forward?
So in some ways, John Bolton has not really been playing the role of National Security Advisor to the President of the United States for many months. There are two basic ways a National Security Advisor wields influence. One is through running a process, you know, the meetings and papers and structures that run the national security decision-making process. The second is by having the ear, being seen to have the ear of the president. It's been clear for a long time John Bolton was doing neither of those things. There was no process, and he'd been overruled in such public ways on things like the North Korea talks, where he was literally sent to Mongolia as Trump is setting foot in North Korea, that it was clear that he was providing very little check for many, many months. So what we'll see, as Ed pointed out, is sort of Trump undistilled. What that the challenge that presents to all of us who are trying to offer a commentary analysis here is that means it's all in Trump's head. And as we've seen on these issues, he whipsaws back and forth so unpredictably.
Well, Indira, we've got a list of possible replacements. They include Douglas McGregor, who's a defense analyst, retired Army colonel, Stephen Biegun, Trump's envoy to North Korea, Richard Grenell, the ambassador to West Germany, and Keith Kellogg, Mike Pence's current national security advisor. And then also starring potentially in the role of Henry Kissinger is the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Why do I mention Kissinger? Because he served in a dual role, Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. This has been done before. People are warning against it. But is this Pompeo's extra job to lose?
I think that, in a way, would be the easiest solution for Donald Trump. Remember, he's now going to be going on to his fourth national security advisor. He had a very trusted campaign supporter and campaign aide, former General Mike Flynn, who was his first national security advisor, who was very copacetic with Donald Trump in many ways, but only lasted 24 days, you know, sort of less than the average lifespan of a mosquito because of all the problems he had with contacts he had had during the campaign with the Russian ambassador. General McMaster, another former general, was more sort of from central casting, the type that Donald Trump, the look he liked, the tough guy, but also this intellectual who had written about the Vietnam War and the Iran War, who tried to institute a very careful process that Mike Flynn had dismantled. You know, I would say John Bolton was different in the sense that he was dismantling that process again. He works alone. He's quite different. If Mike Pompeo were to take the job, it wouldn't in many ways be easier for Donald Trump because he'd have the one guy who, as Ed pointed out, is a yes man, who, even though he doesn't agree with Donald Trump on everything, he essentially carries out what the president wants and says the right thing. So he'd have that man in the same two roles. But I think when we talk about John Bolton's legacy, I just wanted to say I don't think we should forget that he will have a very lasting legacy, despite the fact that he only lasted 17 months like Al Haig did in the Nixon administration, for simply having pulled the U.S. out of the Iran deal, pulled us out of the INF accord with Russia, the arms control, and, you know, various other things that really will have ripple effects long down the line. But I think Trump might, in the end, want to go with Mike Pompeo in that dual role.
And I'm still left wondering, as I think many Americans are. Everything I've heard sounds like it makes sense. Pompeo might get the job. We are now distilled to a situation where the president's whims when it comes to the world and national security will be satisfied. He will have no more rivals in the room. But Daniel, I'm still worried about that, about what that means for actual U.S. policy. I suppose we might have to get inside the brain, or at least the tweets of the commander-in-chief himself, to know what that means in terms of our negotiations with North Korea, our negotiations with the Taliban, or even whether we send $15 billion to Iran.
That's right. And I think what is presumably front of mind for the president is the election coming up. He's going to be very, very focused on what is going to play best in rallies on the campaign trail, in debates with a future Democratic contender. I think there's a lot of reason to think that he's going to want to go into that campaign being able to talk about big deals. And as he's shown before, he's pretty good at taking something that is not that different from a deal that was in place before, making a few tweaks and calling it something new. So you could imagine an Iran deal that's basically the Obama-Iran deal with a few changes that he claims is something fundamentally different, and that would work with China, with North Korea, across a whole host of issues.
Indira?
Don't forget, won't be that different in the sense that Donald Trump has always been his own biggest advisor on foreign policy, and he has said that in interviews. He has said, I'm the boss of foreign policy. You know, I'm really the Secretary of State. I don't think that changes, no matter who is there in the official job.
He was asked early in the administration who he reads, who he relies on, who are his gurus when it comes to national security, and he answered famously, myself, because I have an excellent brain. I read myself, I listen to myself, and I watch the shows.
That's right.
And I guess we can expect more of that to continue. I think it will depend on who the president gets in that role. And I think it will also depend, since he watches the show so closely, what the public reaction is to trial balloons like we might send $15 billion to Iran after repeated years of attacks over tweet and into microphones of the Obama administration policy of freeing up Iranian assets as part of the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, the president criticized President Obama in scathing, scathing terms. And now we learn that maybe the Trump administration has learned that that might be a good idea after all. I think public opinion will play a pretty strong role with the president as well. Many of you have been chiming in on our conversation about John Bolton and his exit from the National Security Council and the side of Donald Trump as National Security Advisor. Dane in Roanoke, Virginia writes, the most likely scenario of the John Bolton firing slash resignation is that Bolton tendered his resignation over Donald Trump's downplaying of North Korean missile tests, as well as the ill-advised Taliban summit, which, Indira, you mentioned. Trump refused to accept the resignation so that he could fire him instead. That's a comment from Dane in Roanoke. Ed, you had some thoughts on a replacement, potentially, for John Bolton as National Security Advisor.
Well, I think it's worth mentioning in the context of what Dan and Indira have both been saying, that if foreign policy from now on is all about Trump being re-elected in 2020, then the person to watch is his de facto foreign policy advisor, which is Tucker Carlson on Fox News. Mm. Tucker Carlson, of course, very famously thought that striking Iran would be a bad idea in July, which was something Bolton had been agitating for, amongst others. Trump pulled back from that airstrike on Iran. Tucker Carlson is in favor of ending the endless wars, with which, you know, which is a core Trump promise. Whoever becomes National Security Advisor after Bolton, the first piece of advice is watch Tucker Carlson. Otherwise, as Indira said, you'll have the average life of a mosquito, 24
Has
days.
Anyone been auditioning?
Technically known as two Scaramucci's, by the way, 24 days.
Indeed.
Lots of auditioning. McGregor, of course, yeah. Colonel, retired McConnell, McGregor, Colonel McGregor is on Tucker Carlson's show a lot.
So we can all potentially watch the auditions right along with the president if we're wondering how the job selection process is going.
Indeed.
Let me turn us to Israel, because in just days, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, is up for re-election in a re-election fight himself to serve another term. Earlier this week, Netanyahu announced that if he's re-elected, he'll annex a good-sized chunk of the West Bank, about a third of it. Ed, is this the kind of ignite the base, the faithful base promise from Benjamin Netanyahu that we might expect? What's going on here?
It's not just ignite the existing base, it's expand it to try and get as many of the far-right parties, the religious and the secular ones, that he will need to scrape over that 60-seat threshold next Tuesday. A lot of them, settlers in the West Bank and in mainstream Israel, are skeptical that Bibi suddenly comes up with this a few days before what might be his last election. We might be seeing end of days for Bibi, because he's promised such things before. In 2009, he promised to incorporate the settlements as part into Israel, and he hasn't delivered. And so they see him increasingly as a showman, and this is increasingly as a desperate gambit. It might still work, though.
Now, when Benjamin Netanyahu made that announcement, he said, and I'm quoting, "We haven't had such an opportunity since the Six-Day War, and I doubt we'll have another opportunity in the next 50 years." What did he mean by that?
That was exactly the quote I was going to read you, because I found it so striking, you know, to compare his opportunity now. The opportunity he means is the openness that the Donald Trump administration has shown towards Israel officially annexing more of the West Bank. And he called it a unique one-off opportunity. And to compare that to wartime, when Israel seized the West Bank from Jordan in 1967, which, by the way, most of the world considers occupied territory and considers Israeli settlements or annexations there to be illegal. That is, you know, that is what all of these talks about Israeli-Palestinian peace for the last 50 years have been about, by the way. To say, oh, Donald Trump is giving us this great opportunity is really striking for him to say that. What he's talking about specifically is annexing all Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And if you look at a map of where those settlements are, they're scattered everywhere, essentially. And that would allow you to essentially, he's also talking about annexing the Jordan Valley, which is this really strategic and fertile strip of land along the border with Jordan. So it would have huge implications. As you said, he is trying to ignite that settler base, that right-wing base, and expand it. But he is right now running even or slightly behind his opponent, Benny Gantz, who's styled himself as a centrist who used to be a former chief of staff.
And Benjamin Netanyahu almost definitely relying on something he didn't quite have before, a green light from Donald Trump, President of the United States, a green light from Jared Kushner, chief American negotiator and strategist when it comes to what used to be called the peace process in Israel. But here's chief Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat reacting to this announcement from the Prime Minister of Israel.
What Prime Minister Netanyahu said tonight about asking his people for a mandate to allow that will enable him to annex the Jordan Valley is paramount to a war crime. Annexation of occupied territories is a war crime.
Daniel, what's been international reaction to Benjamin Netanyahu's campaign promise?
So there has been the predictable outcry from much of the world, including the Arab world. Where there has not been much of an outcry is from Washington, and that is probably, as Indira pointed out, the audience that Prime Minister Netanyahu cares most about, alongside those settlers and others to his right that he needs for the election. I would just add to Ed and Indira's point that Netanyahu is not just worried about his political survival, he's worried about his personal freedom. He's facing three counts of bribery and fraud that may come up a couple weeks after the election. If he's in office, he may be able to find a way around those. If he's not in office, he's in real legal peril. So he's a political survivor, but really facing a personal threat here as
now,
well.
Indira, you mentioned Benny Gantz, the challenger in this election. A lot of people have been surprised by a relatively muted response from Benny Gantz. Hasn't really made it a huge oppositional issue. He seems less concerned about it than a lot of people in the United States.
Whether or not he's actually concerned about it, I think, is beside the point. He doesn't want to alienate potential right-wing voters, settler voters, who he's hoping he will come over to him. And Dan makes an excellent point, which is that basically Netanyahu is trying to distract away the focus in this election from the corruption cases against him. And they are very serious corruption cases, and they've been piling one upon another. He wants to take all the attention away from that and put it on this West Bank issue. So why isn't it Benny Gantz's political benefit to, you know, not make much comment about that and keep the domestic focus on Netanyahu being corrupt?
Well, speaking of Israel, Ed, Politico magazine came out yesterday with a story alleging that Israel has been spying on the White House for the past couple of years. If the allegation's true, this wouldn't be the first time. Israel is known to spy on their friends, the Americans. The Americans are known to spy on their friends, the Israelis. Friends, the term friends has limited use when it comes to national security and spying, but Israel has denied the charge, of course. What do we know about this story, whether it actually goes on and whether it's plausible?
Oh, I think it's entirely plausible. I mean, Israel is not a part of the Five Eyes, you know, which are the five countries that share intelligence and supposedly don't spy on each other, namely United States, Britain, Australia, New Zealand and Canada, the five English-speaking countries. Israel has a long record of very effective spying on the United States, and there have been senior American spies who have been put in jail for being double agents. It is something that Donald Trump alternately refuses to believe would happen, but if it does happen, well, so what? It's Israel, they're friends.
All they have to do is ask.
All they have to do is ask. I mean, it is worth mentioning in the context of Donald Trump's attitude towards spies and the recent revelation that he had to withdraw, that the CIA had to withdraw a senior asset in the Russian government after Trump had released classified information to Russian senior government officials. It is worth mentioning that in the next 72 hours, as Bibi faces what might be the end of his career or might not be, that we could expect on past performance Trump to throw him a solid, to do something that will help Bibi over the line in the next 72 hours. What that might be, I don't know. But blowing up a spy allegation would be something that wouldn't help Bibi. So Trump has downplayed that.
It is worth remembering, I think, that in the now infamous story where President Trump did reveal classified information to two Russian senior officials in the Oval Office, it was Israeli intelligence that he burned. It was the existence of an agent within the ranks of ISIS that the president talked about, that the Russians found out about it. Now, reporting about pulling the Russian spy, our asset, out of Moscow, Subsequent reporting has suggested that the burning of that intelligence was not the reason. Other reporting says it was part of the reason. I guess we'll have to wait for books and more reporting to find out just how true that is. But I do think it's interesting that the intelligence that the president did burn, the asset that he burned when he told the Russians in the Oval Office in a boasting fashion, that was Israeli intelligence, and that was an Israeli asset that he burned. Let's talk about Afghanistan, because this week marked the 18th anniversary of 9/11. And last weekend, President Trump, we've talked about it briefly already, announced on Twitter that he was canceling secret peace talks with the Taliban at our very own Camp David in Maryland, scheduled for Sunday. He brought up the failed talks during his remarks at a 9/11 memorial ceremony on Wednesday.
The last 4 days, we have hit our enemy harder than they have ever been hit before, and that will continue. And if for any reason they come back to our country, we will go wherever they are and use power the likes of which the United States has never used before. And I'm not even talking about nuclear power. They will never have seen anything like what will happen to them.
Daniel, what's the backstory here?
So there has been an ongoing negotiation between U.S. officials and the Taliban under this administration led by Zal Khalilzad, trying to find some kind of deal that would allow a U.S. exit. The Taliban wants U.S. troops to leave. We have about 14,000 troops there now. And we want some kind of assurance from the Taliban that they will, first and foremost, not allow Afghanistan to be used for a base for terrorist attacks on the United States, but also to play nice with the Afghan government. We've been reportedly approaching some kind of deal. Trump had the idea opposed by John Bolton and others in his administration of bringing the Taliban and Afghan government officials to Camp David to sign off on the deal, even though it wasn't quite ready, and things fell apart. Exactly why they fell apart isn't clear, but it is clear that there is not a deal in place right now.
Indira Lakshmanan, a Taliban spokesman, told Al Jazeera that the cancellation, quote, was astonishing for us because we had already concluded the peace agreement with the American negotiating team. The Taliban negotiators were surprised by the cancellation. They were ready for action.
Right. And the deal purportedly that would have been signed would have had the U.S. immediately beginning to reduce the 8,600 coalition troops that we have there, withdraw all of them by the end of 2020, which is soon, next year, close all 5 U.S. military bases there, release thousands of Taliban prisoners that are now in Afghan government custody, and would leave sort of the governance of the future of Afghanistan to within Afghanistan, the U.S. having nothing to do with it. One of the things I found most striking about this proposed deal, which apparently Trump was ready to sign, was that the country's name was going to return back to the name it had under Taliban rule, which is Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And all Afghans would have perceived this as the U.S. basically surrendering their country to Taliban rule. And I think they would have been right in perceiving it that way. You know, the U.S.
That's
has
the
said
of, that's the branding of a caliphate.
That is the branding that they had when the Taliban was in power up until 9/11. And, you know, let's not forget, the U.S. has made plain that while all those good things that have happened since the bring down of the Taliban, such as girls in schools, more women's rights, women serving in office, certain quotas for women in the government, women in the military, etc., that those are all nice things, development goals, but that's not what the U.S. is concerned about. The U.S. is concerned about national security. But taking all U.S. forces out, taking bases out, none of that seems to really be ensuring U.S. national security, given that the Taliban had hosted al-Qaeda in the past and probably would do it again.
Ed?
Yeah, the parallels with Vietnam, where, you know, Kissinger and Nixon wanted a decent interval between the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam and the victory of the communists and the fall of Saigon, is really uncanny. And your point, Indira, about the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan kind of gives the game away, that the Trump administration, with the exception probably of John Bolton until he left, was quite happy basically to leave Afghanistan to the Taliban. They excluded the Afghan government from the talks at the insistence of the Taliban. They accepted the Taliban's refusal to hold a ceasefire whilst the talks were going on over the last 8 months. And it's pretty clear now, with Bolton out of the way, we're going to get back to that in a few days. Somewhere or another, Trump's going to go back to, again, this 2020 thing, I need to put out of this endless war before I face re-election.
Sending Lindsey Graham running for the phones, because at the heart of this from the American perspective is the perennial debate, the endless war, the desire to get out of the endless war, get the troops home, the money spent, and the grinding effect on the American psyche and certainly on American troops, versus the Bolton-Lindsey Graham view, which is endless or not, the Taliban represent an American security threat, and if you leave Afghanistan now, you leave them free to breed another generation of Islamist terrorists who will target the United States. This is the Grahamian view, I think, and I think he is burning up the phones on the president right now. But this came up during the Democratic presidential debate last night. Senator Elizabeth Warren said she would be willing to pull troops out of Afghanistan without a peace deal in place, and she defended her position by describing what she hears every time she asks a general to describe what victory would look like in Afghanistan.
What you hear is a lot of because no one can describe it. And the reason no one can describe it is because the problems in Afghanistan are not problems that can be solved by a military.
Elizabeth Warren is in the Bring Them Home camp. Daniel?
It's another reminder of just how strong that consensus has become in American political life at this point. Trump and Pompeo also said after the Camp David summit fell apart that they would continue withdrawing troops with or without a deal. And it's just a reminder of how finished Americans are with this war. It's worth remembering, though, that last year was, I believe, the bloodiest year on record for Afghan civilians. So even if the American war, which has gone on for 18 years, is going to end, that's not the end of the suffering in Afghanistan.
But what happens if and when somebody like Lindsey Graham burns up the phone and says to the president, it is a grinding war, I know you want to end it, I understand, but there is a lingering security risk there, Mr. President, don't pull out entirely.
Right, and Lindsey Graham has kept, even though he, you know, had called Trump an idiot in the past during the campaign, he's in his good books now because he wants to use his influence on things like foreign policy, and he's not the only one. Don't forget Rand Paul on one end, Liz Cheney on the other end in Congress are also trying to influence him. I think he will be influenced somewhat by that, but ultimately, if he thinks it's a winner in 2020, he'll do what Dan said and pull out.
It's the Friday News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick. Before we get back to our conversation, it's almost time for another installment of the 1A Movie Club, but you might want to leave the kids at home for this one, because this month's film, it's called Hustlers. It's inspired by a New York Magazine article that went viral. Hustlers tells the true story of former strip club employees who joined forces to swindle their Wall Street clients during the 2008 financial crisis. It stars, get this list, Jennifer Lopez, Constance Wu, Lily Reinhart, Kiki Palmer, and Cardi B. It's distributed nationwide today. So if you have seen the film or plan to see it, if you're going to the theaters this weekend, we'd love it if you would send us your review. How many stars out of 5 would you give it and why? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, or send us an audio file with our app, 1A Vox Pop. We'll review Hustlers, spoilers and all. So see it this weekend. If you don't want those spoilers, share some of your thoughts. That's this Monday on 1A. Indira Lakshmanan, we were talking more about the Taliban and the Democratic debate last night, and you had some key observations about what you saw and what you didn't see from those 10 candidates on the stage when the issue of the Taliban came
right
up.
Right, changing gears radically from thinking about the movie Hustlers.
There
was something completely different on the airwaves last night with the Democratic debate. And what really struck me deeply was how profoundly shallow the conversation about foreign policy was. And I mean this across the board. The candidates didn't seem to care, didn't seem to have dug deep on the issues. If they did, they weren't interested in sharing that knowledge with the American people. You know, the fact that Elizabeth Warren would say, I don't understand when the generals tell me what we're doing in Afghanistan, it's not. I understand that across the board there's consensus on ending all wars, pulling out U.S. troops, but that's a completely different animal from talking about why you would want to leave Afghanistan a better place than it was before 9/11, why you would want it to no longer be a haven for a Taliban government, a absolutely radical government that gave haven to al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden who bombed us in 9/11.
I think that's
crazy.
Right. They barely got beneath the slogan.
They didn't talk about anything other than let's get out. They weren't thinking about any other issues. And that troubles me because it means that somehow, you know, Trump in this election, other issues have sucked all the oxygen out of the room from talking about global issues that very much affect us at home. And if all the candidates are not thinking hard about these issues, not a single person on that stage criticized the notion of inviting the Taliban, who hosted al-Qaeda, to the hallowed ground of Camp David, where serious peace talks happened before, and a, you know, historic landmark peace deal was made between Israel and Egypt. It's stunning.
Well, it is stunning, and I think it points to possibly part of the structure of these debates as well. Instead, I realize the field is big, and that's just the way it is. Everybody has a right to run. Instead of having these free-for-alls with 10, 20 people over two nights, three nights, and it's a hodgepodge of issues, divide these debates up into issue-oriented debates. Let the public see these candidates drill down on foreign policy in a foreign policy-only debate, a domestic policy-only debate, an immigration debate, a climate debate, if you like. Let's get issue-specific, and maybe we won't have situations where complex, important issues where lives are at stake aren't boiled down to warmed-over slogans that don't really teach anybody anything about how somebody would behave as commander-in-chief. Well, I want to issue some news to you that won't be news at all. Politicians lie. Yes, they do. Some politicians lie more than others, but misleading the Queen of England, that is not on, as they say. That's exactly the charge leveled this week at the British Prime Minister. It concerns the advice that he gave over the current suspension of Parliament ahead of next month's Brexit deadline. Did Boris Johnson really lie to the Queen?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not, the Prime Minister says. This is the latest charge. It capped a tumultuous week, one that saw street protests and outrage from lawmakers who believe the Prime Minister is trying to silence his critics. Remember, Boris Johnson has promised that the United Kingdom will leave the European Union, do or die a no-deal Brexit if necessary, at the end of next month. Now, there comes a time in every international edition of the Friday News Roundup these days when we turn to a learned Englishman or Englishwoman who's here to sit in a chair and decode for us what has gone on in the last crazy week in that wonderful British English Isle. The courts are now involved, Ed Luce. What's going on?
Can I just correct your intro of me there?
Please.
Learned is wrong, but Englishman I would dispute too. British. My mother's from the Scottish side, and that's a term.
You have to get these details right.
It's an important detail nowadays.
And it is.
What is going on? Well, when Boris Johnson says absolutely not in terms of whether he lied to the Queen or misled the Queen, it does sort of raise a deep philosophical question. What do you believe a liar when you ask them whether they lie? And they say no. Boris Johnson, not to put too fine a point on it, has built his entire career through journalism and now politics on inventing stories, making up quotes. He was fired from the Times of London for inventing a quote. And he's not going to change now. The key question at the moment, the Scottish court having declared that he misled the Queen on his reasons for suspending, for proroguing Parliament for 5 weeks, and that therefore that prorogation is illegal. The key question now is whether the Supreme Court of the UK, which is the highest court of appeal in the land, will uphold the Scottish ruling. And if it does uphold the Scottish ruling, will Boris follow the law? Will Boris actually do what the Supreme Court tells him to, and that is reconvene Parliament? And it's a very open question. People around him, including his Rasputin-type character, Dominic Cummings, have been indicating, nope, we'll just ignore the law. And then what do you do?
BuzzFeed reported just this week, replete with some pretty damning screen grabs of WhatsApp messages between conservative MPs and some of their colleagues, urging the Prime Minister to go ahead and ignore the law, ignore the legislation, get that no deal Brexit if you have to, sort of cheering on the Prime Minister. Conservative MPs saying the law be damned, go for it.
Yeah, and there's a strong sort of case to be made that it might work. I mean, anybody who watched the pantomime in the House of Commons last week might have come out thinking that Boris is finished. But in fact, according to some polls, his numbers went up. The theory is there are only two parties left in Britain, the Leave Party and the Remain Party. And all these niceties and British traditions and conventions and parliamentary procedures mean nothing. That's the Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson theory, and it might be right.
Well, let's talk about the niceties of British procedure and British traditions, because the Speaker of the House of Commons, he's famous now in the United States, John Bercow, announced his decision to step down. He did not go quietly. Here's just a little bit of what it sounded like.
They only require advice on order from you, Mr. Stewart. You're a master of disorder, man. Mr. Stewart, if you don't like it, you're perfectly entitled to your view. I couldn't give a flying flamingo what your view is.
Now, flying flamingo is a very traditional British parliamentary procedural word, but Ed, John Bercow, who we just heard from, says he will do whatever it takes, and he will allow additional procedural creativity, those are his words, to stop Boris Johnson from executing a no-deal Brexit. There will be no Brexit without an endorsement from the House of Commons, so says John Bercow.
And that is according to the law, and he's the one who can, he's got the most power to uphold the law. But again, we're in uncharted territory. I mean, if you think of this sort of in American movie terms, this is a mixture of Groundhog Day, because it's the same debate over and over, and Thelma and Louise, because we keep going towards that cliff. John Bercow believes correctly that it is his constitutional role to uphold the law, what Parliament passed, which is we have requested an extension of Brexit. And Boris Johnson is refusing to go to Brussels to request that extension. So what gives? Do you send the London Metropolitan Police Force into Downing Street to arrest Boris Johnson? How do you uphold the law in a situation that is absolutely unprecedented? And John Bercow might be the best substitute for a policeman in this circumstance.
And Indira, what if the situation migrates away from 10 Downing Street into Brussels, into the EU? And I ask it because Bloomberg News had a wild report this week that Boris Johnson might be cooking up a plan, a deal with Hungary's Viktor Orban, where Orban, as an EU executive, would simply refuse to go along with another Brexit extension. And because of the rules, the procedures, if you like, of the way the EU works, if that happens and there's not consensus, game over.
Well, several points about that. First of all, Viktor Orban is barely in the EU in the sense that he disagrees with so much that the EU does that although he still has a vote and EU policy has to be unanimous, as we know, he might be the next one out the door as well. I mean, he doesn't like the strictures that he feels coming from the EU, but it might be a very clever ploy to have a sort of blackball vote in there that prevents an elongation of this process. What I will say is that EU diplomats I've spoken with have said they had been hoping that Britain would revoke the Brexit plan and just come back to its senses and come back. And now they're so frustrated, they can't wait for it to go. So, you know, there's also been some frustration in Brussels and among member states who are like, okay, already, get out of here. We can't take it anymore. And let's not forget, just back to the prorogation of Parliament, the shutting down of Parliament that Ed was talking about, this suspension for 5 weeks is the longest prorogation of Parliament in almost a century, and it's happening right in the middle at the deadline of what is arguably the biggest crisis in Britain since World War II. So it's stunning that it would be allowed to go on.
Ed Luce, you objected to the name learned Englishman. I accept the objection on Englishman since you are British. Learned, you have to stick with. I'm giving you that one, and you'll have to stick with it. I know that we've called attention to your excellent education in Britain before. I know we like to jab you on that one, but learned indeed. But we also have a learned China expert in the room, and that's Daniel, because there's a lot of China news. Trade clashes between the United States and China seem to be ratcheting down a little bit this week, Daniel. The president announced that he would hold off on another round of tariffs. The Chinese government, within the last 48 hours, seemed to reciprocate or ratchet down in kind. I think they bought 8 or 10 boatloads of American soybeans, a big purchase which will make farmers happy, certainly make the White House happy. Yet another step in a complicated dance between the United States and China. Is this ratcheting down real? Is it prelude to talks? What's going on?
So we've seen these cycles before, these cycles of growing tension and then or a degree of cooperation in the sense that some kind of agreement is possible. What's underlying this and has been for some time is that there are really two strands to the U.S.-China economic competition. There are the tariffs and the questions of how many tons of soybeans or pork the Chinese buy, the kind of stuff that Donald Trump likes to tweet and talk about. There's also a much deeper set of issues that have to do with Chinese theft of American intellectual property and how they treat American technology companies, forcing them to hand over technology, how they treat their own companies. And Donald Trump has never quite decided whether he's content to accept something on tariffs and tons of soybeans or whether he wants to address those much more fundamental questions. If he settles on the first, then an agreement should be within reach. But that doesn't really get at the heart of the concerns about China and the United States today.
What about politics here, Daniel? Has President Trump decided that a trade deal is critical for his reelection? And if the answer is yes, Isn't that leverage for China, who will see their interlocutor desperate for a deal?
That's right. So there are politics on both sides. Donald Trump faces an election in 2020. Xi Jinping does not face an election. So he has an ability to weather a little bit more pain than Donald Trump does over the next year. And the Chinese know that. Donald Trump is starting to see real harms to the American economy, real worries about the possibility of recession, in part because of the trade war. And as he looks to the coming campaign, the economy is really one of the strongest cases he has to make to swing voters who he's going to need for the election. His base might not care, but there are swing voters who are going to look to his economic record. If he loses that point, then he's facing a pretty tough re-election.
We'll be keeping our eye on ongoing trade negotiations and maneuvering between the United States and China when it comes to trade. Before we go for the hour, I've lived in Canada. I lived there for many years. They watch our elections in part because they're interested and in part because they are forced to. So let's spend a couple of minutes watching their elections. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced that he's running for re-election this week. The leader of the Liberal Party kept many of his campaign promises, but he's not particularly popular across Canada, Ed. Why is he not popular? And he has some discretion. Why an election now?
An election now, but partly because he's got out the way, or thinks he's got out of the way, the big scandal from earlier this year, SNC-Lavalin, this big Canadian company, was involved in a corruption scandal, and he intervened, according to the former Attorney General. He intervened to try and prevent it from being convicted, which would have debarred it from government contracts. And so his squeakier than clean image of being Trudeau, the best face Canada can put forward, was very tarred by that. Also by the fact that the Attorney General was a woman and there was another female cabinet minister involved, and he's Mr. Feminist, and this tarred his reputation as being a feminist too. The other thing is, we've got a downturn coming. Whether 2020 is going to be a recession or not, we don't know, but it's a pretty reasonable bet that the earlier you call an election, which you're allowed to do in Westminster style system, the safer you're going to be. They're neck and neck, 30% each, Conservatives and Liberals. It's touch and go whether he's going to be reelected.
Well, we on this show will be keeping our eyes north of the border and on the election going on among our Canadian friends. But before we go for the hour, let's leave North America for a moment. Let's leave planet Earth entirely. Let's go far, far away. How about 110 light years away for some exciting firsts from our own NASA? NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, just up the road here in Washington, announced this week that the Hubble Space Telescope discovered an exoplanet with some tantalizing properties. We've discovered thousands of exoplanets orbiting other stars. That part's not super exciting anymore. But good old K2-18b has water. And not only does it have water, it's orbiting in its star's habitable zone. That's the distance from a star where liquid water can cool and collect on the surface of a rocky planet, like in a lake or in an ocean. It's also called the Goldilocks zone. And you know why. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. It might be just right. Now, Hubble's discovery, gang, is not proof of life. But as far as we know, liquid water is a necessary ingredient. And if there were K2-18 beings on this massive planet, they would have to be able to go for a swim. So exciting news from K2-18b, and so many questions. Do they have polar ice caps there? Did they ever have them? Did they go around and melt theirs? Stay tuned for more from the Hubble Space Telescope. I want to thank my guests for the international edition of the Friday News Roundup. Indira Lakshman, on executive editor of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, executive editor of Foreign Affairs and author of The China Mission. And Edward Luce, chief columnist and commentator for the Financial Times, learned Brit, who joins us on the show. Ed, thank you. This program comes to you from WAMU. It's part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. 1A senior team is Denise Couture, Danielle Knight, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Rupert Allman is our executive producer, and this episode was edited by Orion Donovan Smith. To learn more about the team, you can visit the website, the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.